whenever we speak about a Yom Tov, I like to preface it with something that I heard Shimshon Pinkas say, which I think is just really the way of setting any discussion on a Yom Tov in perspective. Shimshon Pinkas said that when he was a kid, he always found it amusing that when you go to a shir before a Yom Tov, the speaker invariably makes the Yom Tov out to be the most important Yom Tov on the Jewish calendar, the most important day on the Jewish calendar, right? This is what it's all about. And Shimshon Pinkas said, okay, first time as a kid I heard that, it was a bit inspiring. And then I came to the next Yom Tov, went to a speech. Oh, this is the Yom Tov that it's all about. Every time you go to a shir on a Yom Tov, it's made out to be the day of the Jewish calendar. So he said, as a kid, I laughed. And then I developed into a public speaker. I found myself doing the same thing. So, speak in public. A big part of what he spoke about were the Moyadim. I found myself doing the same thing. And he said, but at that point I understood that it's actually not so funny. It's actually true. If you hear a cardiologist talking about the importance of the heart and how everything about the human body depends on the heart, and the heart is what it all boils down to, the heart is the spark of life, etc., etc., he's not exaggerating. And then you hear a neurologist talk about the brain, and he talks about how the human body is nothing without the brain, and everything is about the brain. It's not exaggerating either. And then if you hear the liver described as what it all depends on, and you hear the kidneys described as what it all depends on, nobody's overstating. It's all true. Because, yes, each one has a different function, and you can't say, well, look, if the main function is the heart, so in the worst case, you make do without the kidneys and the liver and the brain. There's no such thing. Each one contributes things that the others don't contribute, and it's absolutely vital. So this is just, in general, a perspective that we have to have about a Moyadim. We have to know that, in general, the Moyadim, there is no such thing in Judaism as just commemorating an event that happened in the past for the purpose of commemorating an event that happened in the past. There's no such thing. We don't have any such Yom Tov. Any Yom Tov that was established whether by Hashem or by the Chachamim, was established because of the lesson that Yom Tov brings home, and that it impresses upon our mind. And when we're talking about the cycle of the Jewish year with all of its different features, each one is contributing something to the Jewish consciousness, to the Jewish personality, that really is meant to be a component of our mindset as a Jew all year round. And this includes the entire Jewish calendar. It includes, obviously, the three regalim. Of course, it includes Yom Ne'arayim. We all understand that. It includes Hanukkah and Purim. It even includes the 3 weeks, 9 days, Tisha B'Av. All these things are things that are pressing upon our minds, things that we're supposed to be living with these consciousnesses all year round. So, having said that, let's approach Purim. What's Purim about? So again, in a simple sense, commemorate something that happened a long time ago. If that's the point, there are a lot of other similar things that we could commemorate. Purim was on a bigger scale, but there were many points where the Jews were saved from all kinds of plots. So, what is it? What is the message of Purim? That's really, what are we celebrating? When we're celebrating on Purim, we're busy celebrating, what we're really supposed to be doing is internalizing what the Yom Tov is. What are we doing on Purim? Okay. So, first of all, let's start by noting that Purim and Hanukkah, most of the things that we're going to say about Purim now have to do with Hanukkah too, are unique in their status, in that they are derabbanan. They're derabbanan. But yet, they aren't really relegated to a second-rate level. Both the mitzvahs in Purim and Hanukkah have the issue of pirsumei nisa, publicizing the nes, which is granted a lot of weight in halacha, which, interestingly, we may or may not, at least simply understood, we don't have that concept by the mitzvahs d'oraisa, by Sukkot, by Pesach. There's no issue of pirsumei nisa. Pirsumei nisa is something that's meant to be publicized outwardly in a big way, and we don't necessarily have those things by the Yom Tov d'oraisa. This is something in which the specifically the Dirabbanans have over the Dirabbanans. That's interesting to know. It's going to have bearing on what's coming now. But even more interesting, and this is really connected, is that both the Yom Tovim of Purim and Hanukkah both took place after the Golos, in the period of the Golos. Hanukkah was in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, but in the broader perspective, that period was part of the Golos too. We didn't have the Shekhinah with us as we did in the first Beis HaMikdash. The way Rav Hirsch terms it is, the period of the second Beis HaMikdash was a preparation for the long Golos ahead. It was a, we were settled back in Eretz Yisrael just in order to brace ourselves for what was coming. These are both things that happened in the Golos. Okay, what's the significance of all this? Meanwhile, this is just a preamble. Let's get to the point. Avishum ben Yechai's Talmidim asked him, why did the Jews of that time deserve such a decree? Why was this decreed upon them? So he answered them, in true Jewish style, he said, what do you say? Why do you think it was decreed upon them? They said, because they bowed down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. Right? Remember the story? Bowed down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. So he said, well, if that was the case, why was it decreed upon all the Jews of the world? Let just those people get wiped out, and that's that. So they said, so you tell us. So he said, it was because they enjoyed the feast of Achashverosh. Okay, how that exactly answer the question? What's that?
I wasn't there.
You weren't in the time of Haman either. Haman didn't decree anything on you. We're asking, why were those Jews deserving of Haman's decree?
Why were the Jews deserving of Haman's decree? They asked him, why is it right now? Why are we still those?
No. They were asking, why was the decree imposed? Why did the Jews deserve to have Haman decree to wipe them out? If it's because of the time of Nebuchadnezzar, that was a generation earlier. They should have gotten it. Why this generation? What's that?
The Jews from all the entire...
No, they didn't. It was the Jews of Shushan. But at least it's a little closer. It's that generation. But the dialogue itself requires a little bit of explanation, because if he had the answer, why he asked them? Chacham didn't usually work that way. Why did he ask? He knew the answer. He had his answer. Why is he asking him, well, what do you think? And the answer is that he was imparting a message there too. We, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, we lived with the open hand of Hashem, open Hashgacha. Everything that happened, we saw Hashem doing. In the time of the Galus, we know that things were behester. And that's why the whole story of the Megillah is the story of Hester. We don't see any open miracles in the Megillah. In fact, Hashem's name is omitted. Doesn't get any mention in the Megillah. It's all Hester. It's all concealed. It's so concealed, by the way, the Megillah did such a good job of concealing that the actual story of the Megillah is also concealed. Sounds like a funny thing to say. But yeah, the whole story of the Megillah conceals the real story of the Megillah. It's not. It's hidden there. What do I mean? What am I talking about? Let's see. But that's how concealed it is. If the true story of the Megillah is covered over in the Megillah. We'll see. Now, yet, Jews are expected to understand that Hashem is never just off the scene. He might be behind the scene, but he's never off the scene. Everything that's going on is going on for a purpose, and everything is being orchestrated with Hashem, by Hashem. Even more than that, when the Jews are dispersed in the world, when the Jews are in Eretz Yisrael, of course, Hashem guides all the affairs of Eretz Yisrael. How does it work when the Jews are in dispersal, when the Jews are all around the world? We have to understand that everything going on all around the world is revolving around the Jewish people. We're an egocentric bunch. It sounds very politically incorrect. But we are meant to understand that, yes, any world affairs are somehow pertaining to the Jewish people. I'll give one example. After the tsunami, remember the tsunami in Indonesia? So after the tsunami, Jonathan Rosenblum, you know Jonathan Rosenblum? He writes in a few of the different from newspapers. also writes some not from newspapers, whatever it is. He's often out there defending the Torah's stance in the outside world. So he wrote that the tsunami was a message of Hashem, from Hashem to the Jewish people in order to inspire us to improve. That's what he said. And in one of the papers where he wrote this, there was an indignant letter from some woman, Jewish woman. She was saying, that's a terrible thing to say. How could you say that 100,000 people died in order to provide us with a message? It's so callous. Okay. But the truth is that it's actually the contrary. He was 100% right. And this is a fundamental aspect of Torah approach. He was right. She was wrong. On the contrary, by her denying this, she was rendering those 100,000 deaths meaningless. The result of chance, natural disaster, begins and ends with a natural disaster, and that was that. Either that or relegated to secrets. Good escape. By him saying that the purpose was to inspire Jews to change, we suddenly granted meaning to all those people who died, and even more than that. Say, a person in Indonesia, some Oriental. This is very politically incorrect, but we have to understand that this is the Jewish, the Torah outlook. Some Oriental is born, lives for 87 years, and then dies. His life is basically meaningless. His life is basically meaningless. All the significance of his life is some indirect effect that he somehow had on the Jewish people. All the nations of the world are there to provide us with a background, with a backdrop. And that entails having a lot of nations and millions of people. Some who are more directly involved with the Jewish people, some who are less directly involved with the Jewish people.
There's no sense of Ashvachpratis or Din, like with the Goyim?
Not much.
Or Mina Kenegan Mina, like all the different ways that Hashem works.
Not much.
You see that he did against Paro and these kinds of things.
Okay. Okay. Yes, that is exactly the definition. The Kadmonim tell us that no, there isn't Hashgacha Protest of the God. There's Hashgacha Klalis, meaning, whereas with Jews there's something called specific Hashgacha, there's Hashgacha on the individual. With Goyim, the way it works is, and again, these things can't be quoted obviously, but the way it works is that there is Hashgacha Klalis, there's general Hashgacha, meaning Hashem has his plan for this nation, which works into the scheme of things of what he wants with the Jewish people. And this is also the concept of sarim, right? We know that each nation has its sar, an angel guiding it, which basically means that Hashem decides. It's like ministers of different ministries, right? And the government as a whole allocates this amount of funding to that ministry and that amount of funding to that ministry, and then each minister has to figure out how to deal with it. That's how it works with the sarim of the Goyim. Hashem does not take kiviyachol, a personal interest in each individual. Hashem does not plan the affairs of each individual. They exist in the framework of their nation, they're a part of their nation's destiny and fate, and that's that. So here is where there could be Hashgacha Pratis for the Goyim. This is what you mentioned. Here there could be Hashgacha Pratis by a Goy. When there's a specific Goy that has bearing on Hashem's plan for the Jewish people, Hashem will take a more personal interest in his affairs. Hashem will also circumvent the Tsar in charge of that nation in order to get to that guy. And that's why, for example, right, Paroi got what he got. But this is the way it works. And therefore, on the contrary, if an Indonesian died and through his death inspired a Jew to take davening more seriously, his life had a lot more meaning. How that manifests in the next world, I don't know. If it does and how it does, I don't know. But the very fact that he served to inspire a Jew will certainly make his existence afterwards a more pleasant existence. It's just by the fact that, yes, he had a direct effect on Hashem's big plan. And to take the egocentricity a bit further, he's a psukim. Pasuk says, "Hu Hashem Elokeinu b'chol ha'aretz mishpatot." He is Hashem, our God, and His judgments are going on all around the world. Everything Hashem is busy doing is revolving around the Jewish people. Anything that you see happening in some remote nation somehow affects the Jewish people. How you don't see any connection? Well, maybe it's preparing the ground for events that are supposed to happen in 700 years from now. The Gemara says, for example, and this is close to prophetic Chazal, Even Chazal said in Gemara's times, when basically all of civilization was around the Middle East, even a ship going from Gaul to Spain, its success depends on the Jewish people. Meaning, whether it will succeed or not succeed depends on how it fits into Hashem's plan for the Jewish people. Now,
you could take this to the extent that you know you could be sort of watching the news ticker all day, you know, like on CNN or whatever. There's always something happening somewhere. You know, there's fires and there's floods and this that, and you just be like, mamish, like going crazy, being still the whole day because there's.
Okay, I'll relate to that soon. Now, what was Gaul? What's Gaul? Gaul is friends, right? Gaul is friends. Gaul in Spain, what was that in the time of the Gemara? In the time of the Gemara, these were the farthermost edges of civilization, which were barely on the map yet. They were completely undeveloped areas, and there was something starting to develop there. But how that would ever connect to any Jew is like, it's very remote. It's like talking about somewhere deep in the Orient or somewhere in the Congo and saying that even a business deal going on between two tribes in the Congo affects the Jewish people. At the time, there was no... But now in retrospect, we see actually what Chazal was saying. Gaul in Spain, Hashem was already building up a few hundred years in advance because nobody knew it at the time. But Hashem had slated them for the time when all Jews will be transplanted from Babel to those areas. That was being built already then. It's also not coincidental that Columbus discovered America on the same year that the Jews were expelled from Spain.
Same day?
I didn't know. So note that on the very year that the Spaniards expelled the Jews, a Spaniard went first. A Spaniard was busy discovering not where they would settle immediately, but where they would settle 500 in 400 or 500 years. This is Hashem. You have to learn to analyze history and see Hashem's fingerprints.
Like it says, the beginning of Hashem sort of planning out the victory.
Oh, this is where we're going with the Megillah. This is what we're getting to. Now, when we approach the Megillah, see, Achashverosh made things. Who was Achashverosh? Achashverosh was the ruler of the world, right? He was the ruler of the world. Massive empire. What were the Jews in that empire? The Jews in that empire were an insignificant entity, dispersed, scattered around. And there were big things going on in Shushan, big things going on in the capital. We hear that the king made a feast. Okay, it's interesting news, etc., etc. But who's going to connect it to the Jewish people? But no. The truth is, no, the purpose of the feast was, well, first of all, to test the Jews. But second of all, because it was supposed to cause Shalom Bayis problems in his family, which would cause him to kill his wife, which would cause him to look for a new wife, which would cause Esther to become queen. Then Hashem could activate Haman once Esther is set in place, and then the story would unfold. If we come and say everything you see going on in the palace, in the royal palace in Shushan, was all somehow revolving around the Jewish people, it just seems completely disproportionate. But the truth is that this is part of the lesson in the Megillah. Part of the lesson in the Megillah is to understand just that. Everything is Hashem orchestrating history, and not just that it's Hashem orchestrating history because he has plans for the Persian Empire. No, Hashem is orchestrating all these great big empires because of his plans for the Jewish people. You see big affairs in the big nations, right? You see the things going on in the United States or wherever else in the big places in the world. If you realize somehow or the other, it's all revolving around the Jewish people. Now, this still is not really our main point, because this is not the message of the Megillah. It's part of the message of the Megillah. It's not the message of the Megillah. Now, Shimon ben Yochai's students came to him and they said to him, why did the Jews deserve that degree in that decree in that time? When he answered, well, what do you think? That was really the main answer. He ultimately told them what the answer is, but that was really the main message that he was imparting. He was saying, Rabbi Yisai, I need to clarify something. If you're coming and asking me this question now, you're the disciples of Rav Shimon ben Yochai, were very, very well accomplished Torah scholars. If you're coming and asking me this question now, that's turning on a red light in my mind. I don't know if I was right in accepting you to my yeshiva. You've been hearing the Megillah for many years now. Did you always understand that just as a very fortunate chain of events? Or did you understand that these are all the orchestrations of divine hashgacha, which is actually reacting to the Jewish people's conduct? If it's just a very happy story about how everything fell perfectly into place, and that's what we're reading year after year after year after year, okay, there's no need to really start going and digging out why did this happen, why did that happen. But if that's how you understand it, you completely miss the whole story of the Megillah. You completely miss the whole point. The whole point of it is Hashem's dynamics with the Jewish people. And therefore, if you're coming and asking me, why did they deserve this decree, I'm going to have to ask you, where were you for these last 30 years? Up till now, you thought the Megillah is just a story. Suddenly it dawned upon you, oh, maybe this happened for a reason. Why are you asking me why it happened? It was the result of political developments. It happened because there was an anti-Semitic guy in power. That's why it happened. So he asked them that question, and they answered. They answered that it was because of a certain Aveira. So he was already calmed. As long as in your mind it wasn't the story of an anti-Semite who was foiled, as long as you understand that, no, the anti-Semite was put there for a reason, oh, okay, I rest assured that you are understanding the point of the Megillah. It's not just a chapter in the story of Jewish history, but that Hashem is conveying messages with the story of the Megillah. In fact, Rabbi Chezkel Avramsky says that perhaps the most important pasuk of the Megillah is all the way at the end when it says Ahasuerus imposed the tax on the islands, right? It's already at the end when we're already 1 foot out, and it doesn't seem to have much to do with the story. And then it says an even more peripheral pasuk, it says, all, if you want to know more about the story of Ahasuerush, and if you want to know more about Mordechai's whole career in his government, see the annals of Persian history. How many? So why is the Megillah here? Why do we have a Megillah? If we want to hear the continuation of the story, we're told, well, go see it over there. So, why are you telling the story up till now? Chazkel Avramsky says that this is also meant to tell us that it's not the story of Mordechai's successes. It's not the story of Ahasuerus's dynamics with the Jews. That's not the point here. The point here is the message that the Megillah conveys. And if historically it stops in mid-sentence, because 1 minute, but we're just starting the story now, and as the story starts, Mordechai is entering the king's service, he did all kinds of great things undoubtedly for the Jewish people, you're not telling us any of that? No, that's not important. You want to learn history, go learn history. The Megillah is not about history. The Megillah is conveying a message. So what's the message? Apparently. Well, it's in itself. Well, let's see. Could be that not being awakened enough, isn't it? Let's see.
You know, the moral
okay.
Is the vase with 48
of the view. Well, let's see how it'll work into. Okay. So now let's step back and really get the story of the Megillah. Let's really get the story of the Megillah. We're going to start, again, we will approach it from a historic perspective. The Jewish people had just ended their moments in the sun. They had ended the period of the first Beis HaMikdash. First Beis HaMikdash was basically open line with Hashem. Open Hashkacha, Nevuah, prophecy, etc. The truth is that the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash was something completely unthinkable. Before it happened, the Jewish people didn't believe that it would happen. In fact, we see that the Nevi'im was struggling to get the Jews to believe that it could happen. Right? They saw the presence of Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash. We don't begin to be able to relate to the experience of life in those days. But whatever it is, the Jewish people's spiritual level was declining, it was deteriorating, until it reached a point where Hashem said, I have to make a very major message. I have to jolt them in a very severe way. And that severe way came in the form of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The unthinkable happened. The place where Hashem openly resided was invaded and was destroyed. Now, the way Reb Shimshon Pinkus puts this is, we're told, Chazal say, that Hashem did chesed He just poured his wrath out on the stones of wood of the Beis HaMikdash. So the way Rav Shimshon Pinkus puts this is, he says, you have an artist who drew a beautiful painting, a painting of his life. He did it actually in the heart of nature. He sat on a cliff and painted the view that you see from the cliff. He painted the view, you see the whole scene. And he finally finishes, he spent a month doing it, he finishes mamash, a magnificent painting, and he invites a friend of his to come see his work. And he brings his friend up to the top of the cliff, and their back is to the cliff, and they're looking at the painting. And the artist, he never really took in, finally finished working it, but he never really took in the full grandeur of the painting. So he steps back to really get the full thing. He wants to appreciate it better, he takes another step back. Now the friend is standing there, but he's got his back to the cliff. And the friend is standing there, and this guy is focused on his painting. He takes another step back. And the friend yells out, "Hey, you're getting a little close." But he's so caught up with the breathtaking beauty of his painting, he takes another step back. And the friend is already too far away to catch him. The friend is standing near the painting. So he's two steps away from the edge of the cliff. The friend just goes and tears the painting in half, and the guy is shocked. And he stops taking steps back. He says, "What'd you do?" He said, "I saved your life. That's what I did. Ruined months of work. I saved your life. That's what Hashem did to the Jewish people." So, okay, they weren't standing and admiring the breathtaking beauty of the Beis HaMikdash, but they were taking another step back and another step back. And the shock of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash suddenly brought into perspective how far they had been going, because deterioration is gradual. We look around, that's how it works. All spiritual deterioration is gradual, and that's why people think it's Shkut Paraluch. So you go a little bit of a notch down, a little bit of a notch down, you quickly grow accustomed to that new notch, so it's normal, right?
Just fixing stones, many people died.
That's true. All that, to an extent, could be referred to as sticks and stones also, because the point is, it was physicality as opposed to the Jews going lost completely. What? It was physical destruction as opposed to the Jews going lost completely. This is the way Hashem operates with the Jews. Hashem brings physical destruction in order to wake them up and avoid them from going truly lost, which would be an eternal tragedy. And it's worthwhile, even for those who die in these sorts of situations, it's worthwhile to die in the endeavor of maintaining the Jews as Hashem's people than for the people to go completely lost. This is what Hashem did with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and it was a shock to the Jewish people. It was a shock, and the Jewish people got the message. The point was to inspire them to get back on track. That was the whole point. And they got the message. They left Eretz Yisrael in a daze, in complete shock, not believing that Hashem would actually do this. They realized how far they had actually drifted. And it was basically at that time, first of all, good things came as a result. First of all, the monarchy, which had become corrupted, was finished at that time. Now the Jews were under whose leadership? Let's note this. There was a very important transition at the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. Hashem was manipulating things. 11 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, King Yechoniah was exiled by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was already ruling Eretz Yisrael for a while before the destruction. The kings at that point were vassals. Yechoniah was exiled along with, it says, HaChorosh VeHamaskir. Who are the Chorosh and the Maskir? The top 1,000 sages of the Jewish people were expelled to Babel 11 years before the rest of the nation. The rest of the nation was living under a corrupt monarchy where the situation was just deteriorating. When the destruction actually hit, they were shocked. They realized they have to get back on track, and they were exiled to where? To Babel, where who was waiting for them? These sages had already positioned themselves well in Babel. These were people who were noted for their wisdom, etc. They held important positions in government. All of a sudden, these people now came under the authority of the sages. This is very important to note, which also helped the process. The process was to wake them up. And now, they were transplanted to good conditions for waking them up. They were under the leadership of the right people in Babel. And this galus marked a tshuva process. The Jewish people woke up, they got the message, and they were coming back. But Hashem wanted it to be for real. Of course, right after the tragedy strikes, everybody wakes up. But to bring them back immediately wouldn't necessarily solve the problem, because the inspiration wears off. Hashem wanted it to be for real. There's going to be now a golus of 70 years. 70 years is enough time to test, to see, is it for real? Is it holding? Or not? Can they be brought back? Or not? The Jews settled initially in Babel, and then began spreading around to all 127 countries. Okay. Now, as we said, initially they arrived in shock, and they were determined to set things back on track. They were determined to set things back on track. But this is exactly what Hashem wanted to see. Hashem was testing to see human nature is such that shock and inspiration wears off. But the real test is, will they be able to hold on to their repentant feelings? Will they be able to hold on to their waking up even when human nature starts setting in? Is it going to be solid enough? Is it going to be implemented enough to be something that's going to last? That was the big test. And the answer was, or started to indicate that not. Yes, it was shocking initially. The thought of the Jewish people being exiled among the nations was shocking. But after 10 years, it was a lot less shocking. Things weren't so bad in Babel. And the Jews were treated fairly decently. Babel, Persia, Madai, right, we know, especially since the conquerors were even more friendly to the Jews than the Babylonians were. But even under the Babylonians, it wasn't so bad once they already settled in Babel. Things were okay. Things were comfortable. People started settling. The inspiration started wearing off. Things weren't so bad. Things weren't so bad. It's livable over here. And they started growing complacent and settling into a routine. And this was the big danger. This was the big danger. The fact that they started feeling natural, started becoming naturalized, they started feeling, slowly but surely feeling at home, this was the big danger. And whereas initially they had suddenly woken up to the fact that we need to reconnect with Hashem, no, okay, it started wearing off. And here is where Hashem had to take drastic action. Here is where Hashem had to take drastic action. That's why he brought in a Haman. Now this was represented in the fact that they took part in the Suda V'Achashverosh. Bow down to the statue of the Nebuchadnezzar, okay, fine. That's a whole discussion in itself. But it was under duress, etc. It didn't really represent a general decay that started setting in. But when they took upon him the Suda V'Achashverosh, they were already flattered by the fact that this non-Jewish king wants to draw them close. This was already dangerous. This was dangerous to everything that Hashem was doing with this whole galus. And they started feeling comfortable. Okay, here is where Hashem had to bring in a Haman. Hashem brought in a Haman. To suddenly, it was another, how do you say, when you have an earthquake and then afterwards there's another, the aftershock. Right, this was a very necessary aftershock because the initial quake had its effect. The initial quake had its effect, but the effect was starting to wear off. Haman was an aftershock. And that's the Chazal that you mentioned before. Haman was a very great friend of the Jews. It says that what Haman had a greater effect on the Jewish people, inspired the Jewish people in a bigger way than all the 48 Nevi'im and Nevi'is. He brought them closer to Hashem. Very effective. Decree of annihilation, if you have the right approach. Right? Achman al-Litzlan. When people are completely detached from Jewish sensitivities, even such a thing can go without the right approach. That's what happened in the Holocaust in many cases. Other cases did have the desired approach. But this was what the decree of Haman achieved, if we'll put it that way. And the truth is, if you want to know what the real story of the Megillah is, and like I said before, the story of the Megillah is hidden in the story of the Megillah. What did Chazal come and do for us? What Chazal came and did was, they, in the Megillah, took us almost all the way there. If we had been living in the time of the Megillah, it's very likely Megillah happened over a course of more than 10 years. Right? If I remember correctly, it was about 11 years, if I remember correctly. I could check again. Who would have been living at that time and just following the news, following the headlines? We wouldn't have seen the chain of events. We read the Megillah condensed into 45 minutes, right, everything that was going on, and we see how each thing connected to the other in such a perfect way. But, you know, just following the news, okay, there were all kinds of different developments in the palace, political events, right? Inner struggles in the palace, Haman, Esther, this, that, Vashti. One thing doesn't have to do with the other, okay. Achashverosh got into a fight, it was a scandal in the royal home. Achashverosh killed his wife. It's a minig today too, just that today you can't get away with it, in those times you could. Achashverosh killed his wife. Fine, story finished. Later, a new queen is appointed. Story finished. Later, Haman makes the position of prime minister. Okay, that's the end of that story. Later, there's a power struggle between Haman and the new queen. Haman ends up hung. Okay, kind of makes sense. Because I'll point out that even that doesn't make sense. Well, all part of Achashverosh's wishy-washy personality. So first he killed his wife because of his friends, then he kills his friends because of his wife. Okay, but whatever it is, a lot of Chazal come and tell us, no. Note that there's a whole chain here. Note that there's a chain of events here. It's one chain. Everything is exactly connected to the next thing. That's number one. But the truth is, it's more than that. The real story of the Megillah is lost in all the verbiage of the Megillah. Esther, you almost don't notice this. This is almost not noticed. But the whole drama of the Megillah is where Esther accepts Mordechai's challenge, right? He challenges her, and she says, okay, fast for me for 3 days and three nights. And then she approaches the king uninvited. She risks her life. He almost killed her. She asks him to come to the first party. The first party, she doesn't say anything. The suspense is building up. She asks him to come to the second party. At the second party, she sets someone up perfectly. Boom! The story hits its beautiful ending. And that hides. I just told the true story in the Megillah, and I hit it just the same way the Megillah does. We forgot that what was going on during these days. Esther said what her main strategy is. Her main strategy is, Lech Knoises Kol HaYehudim V'tzumu Alayv Al Tuchu Al Tishtu Shleishes Yomim. She said, go gather the Jews together and daven intensely for me for these 3 days. If we were living in Shushan, we weren't in the palace, we didn't see Esther approaching the king and all that. The story of a Jew living in Shushan was that they were called for a major gathering of tefillah for 3 days. They were in a completely hopeless situation. At that time, by the way, they didn't even know that Esther was Jewish. Right? Mordechai had to keep it a secret. It was for these reasons. Right? Chazal tell us that he didn't want the Jewish people understanding that, oh, it's okay, we have our connections. No. They had no help at all in the royal palace. The situation was completely hopeless. They went in for a gathering of tefillah in a hopeless situation. They davened for 3 days. And they came out, and the world had turned upside down. They came out, and Haman was hanging. That was the story of the Megillah. That's the story of the Megillah. The Jews erred. They started floating away from Hashem. They started growing complacent. They started losing their sensitivities. They were woken up with a harsh decree. They went in, davened intensely, and embarked on an intense tshuva campaign. 3 days, but those were 3 days. Just only try to picture what those 3 days looked like. They were inspired by Mordechai. They didn't feel hopeless. They went in with the feeling of, if we work hard at it enough, they went in with faith. If we work hard at it enough, as hopeless as it seems, we don't know what Hashem could do. It was more than that. They didn't know what Hashem already done. Right? It was all set up already. They had no idea. They went in with what was naturally a hopeless situation. Davened tshuva intensely for 3 days, came out, and it's if the story wasn't already all done. They didn't even have to wait to see what happens. Haman was hanging on the tree. That's the story of the Megillah. So what's the message of the Megillah? What's the message of the Megillah? The message of the Megillah really is this. We are now in the time of Hester. We're at a time when we don't see Hashem operating. But yet we have to remember, we have to always be conscious of the fact that Hashem is right there behind the scenes, focused on us, watching us the whole time, manipulating things around us for us. And our So the critical function that we have is to remain connected. That's really the big challenge. Now, I just want to know, going back to Shushan for a minute, let's note that that had the effect. The point was that Hashem was expecting a level of tshuva from them that would actually bring them back to Eretz Yisrael. It did it, right? They started drifting off a little. Hashem sent that aftershock. And that aftershock did what it had to do. Those 3 days of tshuva and tefillah brought them completely back to the track of the awakening they were supposed to achieve after the destruction. Right? And that's why soon afterwards they came back to Eretz Yisrael. That was all the story of the Megillah. The story of the Megillah really was the beginning of the story of them coming back to Eretz Yisrael and getting the second Beis HaMikdash. So let's note that the Megillah did for them what we haven't managed to do. By then it ended after 70 years. We've already passed the 70 year mark, if anybody didn't notice, in our current Golos. Right? So let's note the intensity of what happened at that time. It had that effect. It had the effect of reminding them, don't start drifting. Hashem gave you a slap. Even more, Hashem went to hide. So initially, they were searching for Hashem. They wanted to reconnect with Him. They couldn't find Him right away. They gave up. They said, we'll play a different game. Nachum of Breslov, I believe it was, who said, one time he was walking through the streets, he was walking with a bunch of his disciples, and they saw a young girl crying. A little girl. They asked her, why are you crying? And she said, we were playing hide and seek, and I hid. I found a really, really great hiding place. When my friends couldn't find me, they just left and they went to play something else. That's why she was crying. She was hurt, disappointed. Okay, so after they made her feel better, Rav Nachman came away and he said, now I understand the tragedy of the Churban. Now I understand what the tragedy of it. Say, what's going on? That's exactly what happened with Hashem and us. Hashem hid Kiviyachol. For the purpose of what? For the purpose of waking us up and saying, how can we remain distant from Hashem? But then what happened? We became complacent. Hashem's not here. It's okay. There are restaurants. A good replacement. There are good times to be had. Vacations. There's all kinds of things that this world has to offer. And we drift off. And we drift off. So then Hashem sent the Haman to wake us up and bring us back. And the Jews woke up and they came back and they reconnected and they stayed connected. And therefore, when Purim comes around every year, what's actually going on? First of all, it's very significant. The Purim is preceded with the Tainus Esther. This year we have Shabbos in between. But Purim is preceded with the Tainus Esther. Tainus Esther is very different than all the other fasts. All the other fasts are sad days. Tainus Esther is not a sad day. That's the whole point of Tainus Esther. Tainus Esther is to commemorate the davening and the fasting that they did at that time, which is what? What was it? It was a hopeful davening and fasting. It wasn't sad. It was a hopeful davening and fasting. It was davening and fasting in an intense effort to regain that connection that we had started losing. And what was Purim? Purim was celebrating the fact that we managed to wake up. That yes, we were drifting, we almost went too far. Haman came, woke us up, we went into shul for those 3 days, and we reconnected. And we're celebrating that we managed to do that. So when Purim comes around every year, that's really the reminder. Instead of needing a Haman to wake us up, we can get that same effect. Purim also is a big bang, right? Listen to the streets. Purim is a big bang. Purim can also serve as the aftershock. Isn't it better if we can be reminded of this concept when we're drowning in wine and when we're busy stuffing our faces at the Purim Suda? The point is, use the Purim Suda to remember the feelings that they had then, to relive the feelings that they had then. When they came out of that, wherever it was that they gathered, I guess the Bet Knesset HaGadol of Shushan, the central shul of Shushan, when they gathered there and they came out and they saw Haman hanging and they understood, yes, we had drifted far, but we endeavored to come back. We pushed our way back to Hashem. And when we step out of shul, we found that Hashem took us back into His embrace. He burst into unbelievable celebration. That was the great celebration. It was also the fact that now they saw clearly that even though they were away from the Beis HaMikdash, even though Hashem is behind the scenes, He's right there behind the scenes. Right there. He's not far away somewhere. He's been busy with us the whole time. He's been visiting with us all the time. Realized it was a trauma when the Jews left the Beis HaMikdash. We're not traumatized by that today. But for the Jews initially, the concept of Hester, concept that there's no Navi to tell us what Hashem is saying, then they still had a few Navim. But the concept that we don't have that live connection with Hashem, for them that felt like distance. They had to overcome that and realize that no, Hashem is really very close. We just have to make sure to keep up the connection. That's what they saw at the time of Purim. That's what they saw at the time of Purim. And that's what they were celebrating. So that's what we should be celebrating now too. For us, we're coming kind of from the opposite direction. Hester is natural. Any talk about Hashem being close by is kind of describing some idealistic utopian situation. But this is what we're celebrating on Purim. We're celebrating or reliving that realization that Hashem is right there the whole time. And He's busy manipulating things all around us. And He's busy caring for us even if we're not there. And we remain the focal point of all historic events. And we remind ourselves also, let's not allow ourselves to drift. Let's keep alive the inspiration that the Jews had at that time. Not make the same mistake. Not start drifting away again. We use Purim as a day, if we were drifting throughout the year, we use Purim as a day of waking up and saying, we want to feel what they felt. We're going to wake up. We're going to regain that connection. We're going to come back close to Hashem. And not just today, but to carry that throughout the year. Now this is why Purim is so fundamental. This is why Purim is the most important of Yom Tovim, right? That's how we started. This is why Purim is the most important of Yom Tovim. Because, in what sense? Pesach? Alright. When Hashem is right openly there beating up our enemies and caring for us, you see Him. Shavuot, Sukkot, supernatural. Of course it's easy to stay connected then. Purim was our first national experience with Hashem. Was the first time the dynamics in Hester manifested themselves. Purim in a way is more relevant to us than Hanukkah. Okay, a lot of things go with Hanukkah. But these Yom Tovim, as opposed to the Shalosh Yigalim, in a way, their message is so much more relevant to us now in the Galus. Because it's that realization that even though we're living in Hester, even though we're living without that live, open connection, Hashem is still just as close as ever. It's just us, up to us to retain the connection.
How does that connect with Hanukkah? Like, your form is saying that it's a connection behind the scenes. Was Hanukkah, Hashem did, like, sort of do miracles, even though it was after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? Is it saying that Hashem works in these two ways, or was that just a separate thing?
Hanukkah very much is expressing the same thing. The fundamental difference between Hanukkah and Purim was they're both showing the same thing, that even when there's Hester, Hashem is still there, and if we make a point of connecting to Him, He'll be there for us. Just that in Hanukkah, the Nes was almost symbolic. Meaning, think about it. What was the open Nes of Hanukkah? There was only one open Nes. One clearly open Nes. The Neiris. What salvation did that bring? What salvation was there in the Neiris? It wasn't really a salvation. The Nes of Hanukkah was symbolic. Hashem was showing the wars, the actual battles, could have been construed as natural. They could have been construed as natural. In fact, people would like to say so today. It's much more popular to say that the Maccabim were a dogged group of mighty warriors, right? Determined. It's a good a lesson for other people fighting for their homeland, right? People would like to say that. You see that being portrayed that way. And on the contrary, the Maccabim were worried about that too. Is this natural? They were there too. They were fighting a hopeless cause. The Greek culture and influence was spreading. It was taking everything over, right? And all other cultures had already fallen. Judaism also had fallen 3/4 of the way. Most people had already succumbed to the Greek culture. Statistically, anybody approaching things realistically in those times understood that it's just a matter of time before it all disappears. So what were these Maccabees fighting for? A losing battle. Fighting to keep the flame going for another 50 years. You're going to kill yourself because of that. So when they saw these battles won, was it because of their doggedness? In which case the whole thing is just not worth the effort. Right? Mighty fighting in order to keep it up for another couple of years. But actually, when they saw that Nes in the Beis HaMikdash, which was just symbolic, it was Hashem's way of showing, realize that all the natural victories and the natural successes were actually me at work. There's more discussion on that, but I'm going to leave that for now. But really, in a sense, it's really the same thing, because the experience of Hanukkah was very different from the experience of the experiences of the first Beis HaMikdash, where things were mamish, out in the open, openly miraculous. In Hanukkah, it was our spirituality we were fighting for. Here it was our physical existence. Alright? Very important.